Wow, very cool. Hi, everybody. My name is Donna Halverson, and I am an alcoholic. Everybody's been wondering, who is Donna H? It used to be Donna E, but I got married in January to this gorgeous cowboy down here in front. And my life is so very, very good today. It's so amazing to be in Seaside. I was just sitting here looking around the room and thinking, I've been to this conference. This is my fourth time, I think, to come to this room. And I have had so many good times here, and I know so many people here. And it's just amazing to come back into a group like this. And the energy and the love, and I mean, this is one of those premier conferences. And it's really, I don't know what it is. It's like, it's just a pocket of enthusiasm. It's a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a passion for recovery. It's a passion for our sober lives. I mean, people here love to have a good time. I mean, you can tell. And they do it the whole weekend long, and it's that way every single time I come here, and I'm so privileged to be here. Over the years that I've come here, my life has changed a lot, and it's really, really, really good today. Alcoholics Anonymous has done everything that it promised me it would. I have been able to stay sober. I have been able to stay sober, and the God of my understanding has brought me through a lot of things. And today, I am so stinking happy. It's just ridiculous, you know? The people around me just kind of get annoyed about, oh, yeah, I know. It's just all so great right now. But the ones who really know me know that it hasn't always been so great. And I'm telling you, when life is good, enjoy it. And life is going to be challenging again soon enough, and that's okay. I'm up for that too. My God, the God of my understanding is up for that, and so is AA. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to see everybody, and so privileged to be included. Harlan, thank you for inviting us to come. I want to share with you what we always talk about. It's in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. I have so much love for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I love AA so much. There is nothing in the world that does it for me like sitting down and looking in the eyes of some woman who honestly does not have an idea that there's a way to live. I mean, and you can tell, you can see it. And I can see it because I used to see it in my own face, you know. There's just nothing that does it for me than that. To just say, you just come on, baby, come on. This is going to work for you, you know. That's the kind of loving encouragement that I've been given in my sobriety. And it just blesses my heart to pass that on. Anyway, I'm from Montana. Sobriety date. Yeah, Montana. Woohoo! My sobriety date is the 5th of May, 1987. My sponsor's name is Polly P. My home group is called 510 Cook Meeting. And I'm very happy for all three of those things. I grew up in Montana. I am a Montana drunk. I did my drinking in those cowboy bars that you could smell before you got to them when you were walking down the sidewalk, you know? I mean, the good ones. And I was a kid that grew up in a home of alcoholism, though, before that. And I really want to love to tell this. One, I don't ever want to forget it. And two, it's the case for so many of us. Alcoholism lived in my home. And I came from a family where there was every single kind of abuse and violence that can happen in a home. Every rotten, horrible thing that could possibly go on was going on. I mean, there were people getting bones broke, people, guns going off in the middle of the night, beatings, neglect. It was a terrifying place. I was the oldest of four kids growing up in that house, and I believed beyond a doubt, without even a question, that the reason those things were happening is in my home is because there was something wrong with me. And I took responsibility for the condition of that household way before I ever picked up a drink. I am a really self-obsessed, self-centered alcoholic. I mean, I think it's all got to be about me. It's all got to be my fault. What I didn't know was that alcoholism lived in my home. You know, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was a really rageful, angry man. And he lived with all his demons. And the truth is, it had nothing to do with me. But when I came here, I thought that that's what made me the way I am. I also know that my childhood was my alibi. You know, my childhood, I mean, all I'd have to do is say, well, this is the kind of stuff that happened to me. Nobody ever said to me, oh, stop your whining and get over it. I mean, everybody always said, oh, my God, that's horrible. You know, things like that should never happen to kids. So it was my excuse for who I was and what I wasn't. I was a scared little kid living in that house. I was... not a fighter. I was not rebellious. My type of rebellion comes through a very finely tuned art of manipulation and control. And I did the best I could to survive that household. And when I was 17, my dad got caught for some things that were going on. And we left town in the middle of the night and moved to Northern California. And I was 17. I'd never been to a dance or a football game, never been on a date. My job was to stay home and raise my siblings. And at that time when we moved, because we were in trouble, they didn't let me go back to school. So I went to work. And I was so naive and so clueless about what was going on. The best way for me to describe this is that I was just a person walking around Earth with a mountain of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. I mean, that was me. I'm just this big ball of that. And I didn't have a single solution for living. When I was, by the time I had turned 9, I really didn't do much. I just worked. I hadn't drank. Did not find a solution for my life. I was insane. Absolutely insane. I don't know. I mean, I needed to drink in the worst possible way. But when I was 19, I moved back to Montana, and I met what has become a solution for most of the problems of my life, was a him. And I met this man, and I knew him 3 weeks. He asked me to marry him. I mean, you know, when somebody asks you to marry him, you can't say no. You might offend him, or, you know. So I've always said I've been very particular about the man I've married. I've married anyone that asked. But I don't have to say that anymore. Anyway, I met this man and married him, and this is what I knew about him. He lived in Charleston, South Carolina. That's a long ways away from Billings, Montana. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll marry this guy. I'll go there, and I'll make a life that's different for me than the life that I had. And he didn't drink. He wasn't a drinker. He was very angry and rageful, but he wasn't a drinker. And I didn't drink. Neither of us had ever found a solution for living. And I married this man, and from the day we got married, in 6 years and 3 months, we had 5 children. And I had 4 little girls and a boy. I am 24 years old, going on 25 years old, and terrified. More responsibility than somebody like me should ever have. And I didn't know what to do with those kids or how to be a wife or a mother. I really brought no skills to this deal at all. I was a really, really, really sick girl. I just remember being so terrified. That mountain of self-loathing, you know, believing that it was that there were things, something wrong with me, something horribly wrong with me. That's why life is always crap. You know, it's just always crap. It just never works out. When my oldest child was 6 and my youngest was 9 months old, we were only married like 8.5 years, even though we had 5 kids, I went to work in the cowboy bars. And I can tell you, I was like 26 years old when I started drinking on a regular basis. And just as sure as I'm standing here today, I know for positive that when I started putting booze in me, I found a power greater than myself that worked for me for the first time. You know, when I could put booze in me, I didn't have to be that scared little kid from Billings, Montana that didn't know what everybody else knew. And I didn't have the secrets. I didn't have that family, those horrible things that I didn't want to remember. You know, the thing about me is that I hated with all my might. I hated who I am and everything about my life. And booze allowed that to change somehow. It was the most amazing thing. I needed it so desperately. Up until that time, I just really had no solutions for living. I remember a guy I used to drink with in Red Lodge all the time. Red Lodge is a little ski resort town about 65 miles from where I live now. And it was just a party place. And this guy I drank with all the time used to say, let's get drunk and be somebody. He was a periodic, and that was his deal. We're like, let's get drunk and be somebody. And I always said, let's get drunk and be somebody else. And, you know, what I know is that that's exactly what makes me an alcoholic. The big book says that many of us don't have to drink the length of time or take the amount that others do. And it says it's particularly true with women. It says that we become the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few short years. And that's kind of what I used to be like, you know. I'm this terrified little person without a single idea about how to do life. 5 children that I'm trying to raise, which was a joke. It was a disaster. You know, I'm to tell you the truth, if I was trying to raise those kids today, CPS would be knocking on my door. You know, I am a mother who neglected and abused and loved and cherished my kids all at the same time. You know, I don't know if you know what that means, but I'm the kind of mom that would walk in the door one day and just wrap my arms around them and tell them how wonderful they are and how beautiful and smart and talented and they can do anything in the world they want to do. And the next day I walk in the house and smack somebody or scream my head off because the dish rag's in the wrong place beside the sink. You know, that's the way it was with me. You never knew what you were going to get. And I drug my children through the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, we got to hear from Beverly last night, and we're going to hear from two other wonderful Al-Anon speakers that I'm really looking forward to. But, you know, listen to what they say, because this is a family disease. You know, I remember being told that alcoholism is a disease that destroys the lives of people that don't even have it. You know, they suffer from alcoholism just like I did. It was, my kids are... they are incredible people. They have always been very cool, very smart, very cool. They're just great people. I have watched and can still watch the disease of alcoholism that affects their lives to this day. You know, Polly is, as my sponsor, has a thing that she said to me a number of times, as you can imagine. She often reminds me that a lot of the problems that my children have might have my name on them, but their solution has their name on it. And, you know, that's not to mean you're on your own, go figure it out, you know, get over it. It's not that at all. It's just that, you know, God doesn't have any stepkids. And I know that for whatever reason, their path has to be the way it is, just like mine had to be exactly the way it was. Every single thing in my life has made me who I am. You know, every bit of violence and ugliness that I experienced as a kid, and then as a young adult, dragging myself, you know, through the disease of alcoholism, living like an alcoholic woman. I tell you, I'd rather die today than go and live like an alcoholic woman again. You know, I was forever doing things I didn't want to do with people I didn't want to know, and consumed with worry about what they might think of me, even though I could have cared less. But, you know, it all dominated my life. No ability to have any idea of who I am or what I believe or what I want or what I stand for or what's important. All of that I've gotten in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA has taught me how to be the woman that I am today. And I'm loving the process of this. My children, you know, have suffered this disease. Day before yesterday, I got a phone call from my youngest daughter, just in tears. And she and her guy, that they've been living together for quite some time and trying to put together a life, and he went out on meth again. And she is just destroyed, you know. She was just sobbing. She was so upset. And, you know, but let me tell you the difference between my daughter and me. What she did was say to him, "Oh, man, that's horrible. I wish more than anything you hadn't done that. You got to go." I mean, I don't. I try to fix them, you know. I try to save them. She just said, "You got to go." And she packed him up and moved him out. I mean, it's 10 o'clock at night. He's gone. And she has two children she's trying to raise, and she's, you know, just knows that her focus needs to be herself and those two kids. And, you know, I didn't get that kind of stuff. I didn't get that. I don't know where she gets that from. And I told her, I said, "Andy, you've been living your life like if you can make everybody around you okay, then you'll be okay." And I said, "The truth is, if you have to wait until they're okay for you to be okay, you're screwed. You're screwed, honey. It's never going to happen." And she said, "What do I do?" You know, she did want to talk about him. She wanted to talk a lot about him. I said, "What about you? You know, what about you? I mean, if you could get some help for you, maybe you won't have to repeat these things again. Maybe you will. You know, maybe you'll have to do it 10 more times. But... you know, this isn't just Scott's lesson. This is your lesson, too." And she was like, you know, I mean, I got off that phone just amazed that she would call her mom, for one thing, because I didn't call my mom. You know, I wasn't calling my mom. That's a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous, that she will call me and tell me exactly what's going on. She even says, "Don't tell my sisters, they're going to be mad." Now, don't you think that's a little bit of a switch? I mean, it used to be, "Don't tell mom." "Don't tell mom, no matter what you do." And I said, "You just tell them when you're ready to tell them, you know, but baby, you just get some help for yourself. You just get some help, you know." And Bob and I were talking about it, and Bob was all full of ideas about, well, we need to see if she needs this and see if she needs that and fix this and fix that. And I said, "You know what, you go right ahead and offer those things, because my job is to be the mama." And I learned the hard way that that's exactly my job. I mean, I'm just going to be the mama, but I'm good at that. I'm really good at that. And that comes from, you know, being able to live my life the way I did and be responsible for my life, learning to be responsible for my life. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that dignity. The sponsors that I have had and have give me that dignity. You know, I know today that I don't have the right to protect somebody from the painful situations that they need in their lives to grow. You know, it isn't easy for me to sit back. I'm telling you, I wanted to jump through the phone wires and hold her when she's crying to me on the phone. But she's 30 years old. She's a woman, and she deserves my respect. You know, and I also know that when I look at the life that I've lived and the path that I've taken, I've done a lot of changes, made a lot of decisions and changed things and done things different that I really wish I hadn't had to do. But every bit of it has made me who I am. I can't honestly regret any of it. You know, my dad, I started to tell you, was the alcoholic in our home, and he was so violent and so angry, and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have given me a tremendous peace when it comes to that. My dad died four years ago in January. And it was, you know, my dad was one of these tough old guys. He was my best lesson in sober, long-term, untreated alcoholism. My dad didn't have a drink for 25 years before he died. But I want to tell you, he was one of the angriest, saddest, most tortured people I have ever known. His world just got littler and littler and littler and littler. And he had a family around him. You know, all of us have come through the path that we came through, had the experiences that we had, but we all had come around to him. And I don't know, it was a weird thing that God did. It was kind of like God let us see him for what he really was. And we loved him, but he couldn't feel it. You know, and I watched that. I watched that for all those years. Every time I tried to make a verbal amends to him, my amends to my father was a living amends, and it was in trying to respect his attitudes and his actions, even though they were nuts, you know, even though they were insane and they were eating him alive. I learned to respect that. I'll give you an example. He'd call me on the phone, and he'd tell me, oh, my life is just so horrible, and I just hate the way I feel, and God, I just wish I'd die, you know? And I used to try to talk him out of it. I used to try to cheer him up a little bit, you know? Oh, Dad, I mean, life is good. And, you know, Mom loves you, and you guys have been together all your lives. And I try to give him all these good, you know, take the high road idea, you know? My sponsor's husband calls that a sunshine enema. I try to give him this little cheer him up pep talk, you know. And what I found out is that that's like trying to teach a pig to sing. You know, it, first of all, you're not going to teach the pig to sing, and it annoys the pig, you know. So it was the same thing with my dad. He would get angry when you try to tell him what was good, because he could see what was bad. And what I learned because of Alcoholics Anonymous is to say things to him like, God, Dad, that must feel awful. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that it's that hard today. You know, just that. I would just give him that. I would just, oh, man, that must be awful, you know. Just give him that. And over those last years, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, a relationship formed that would have never been there. Now, my dad was my primary abuser. You know, he was very, very violent. He scared me to death. I was terrified of him all of my life. And the last 10 years of his life, I came to understand him. You know, I got him, if you know what I mean. I mean, I saw this man who lived with this mountain of fear and anger and guilt and shame. You know, he had not drank in 25 years. He had nothing to anesthetize himself from reality. You know, he had nothing, no solutions, no tools to deal with the ghosts from the past, if you will. You know, the horrible things that he had done to his family. I mean, every time he looked at us, all he could see is what he had created, you know, and we were getting better and moving on, and that was deprived from him. And I came to understand him. The times that I would try to say something to him, you know, in making my amends, I would say, Dad, you know, I want to talk to you about the way things used to be. And he'd say, oh, no, we don't need to go into that. We don't need to talk about that, you know. And right before he died, I knew all my years, since I was a kid, I remember thinking that I would be terrified when my dad died, because he was the big boogeyman, you know, and I don't know why, but it just seemed to me like something had to be done. You know, I don't know what, I didn't have the answers, but it just seemed to me like I was supposed to do something, and I didn't know what for sure. And so when I knew his death was imminent, I knew that I had to say something to him, that I had to actually say something, but I didn't know what. And I was waiting for the, you know, perfect moment when the soft music in the background and there's no one in the room and I can have my little moment, you know. And that wasn't going to happen. My dad was there and all my siblings were standing around and my mom was there. And he was getting down to the end. He was had his eyes closed, but he was still awake. And I leaned over and I said, "Dad, can you hear me?" And he squeezed my hand. And I said, "I just need for you to know that you have been one of the greatest teachers of my life." I said, "I'm not sorry for anything that I learned because it's made me who I am." You know, what was amazing to me is that I didn't have to tell him, you know. I mean, it was true that he was the greatest teacher of my life, but that it had been a torturous, horrible lesson, you know. I mean, I didn't have to do that. I could just say, you know, so many of these things has made me who I am. And I'm grateful for those things. And I said, "You made us strong. We are strong, and we're going to be fine. We're going to take care of each other, and you get to rest." I said, "No more doctors, no more hospitals, no more fear, no more worry. You get to rest." And I'm telling you, I swear to you that I swear I just know in my soul that that man died free. I just know it. It was like maybe the last 10 minutes of his life that he got it, but he got it. He got it that no matter what you do or who you are or how you've lived, that there are people who can know you and care about you in spite of that. You know, I'm not going to tell you he was my daddy. He never was my daddy. He was never the daddy that I wanted. But he was my father, and I learned to respect him. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed it all. You know, people in AA taught me that my job was to pay more attention to what kind of daughter I'm being to him than what kind of father he had been to me. And it was a lot easier to look at what kind of father he had been to me, you know. Real easy to stand behind that victim role. I thank God, and I thank the, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that when he died, I was free. You know, and I knew that he was free. And that was just, that's an amazing thing. See, these steps, you know, I want to welcome the people that are new here. And, you know, this weekend is a weekend of just wild, passionate enthusiasm. And it's love for life and it's love for sobriety. But every single one of us, it all began with sitting down with one other person and doing those steps. You know, and what I'm grateful that I'm experiencing. You know, Beverly said something last night about that this is a process and that she's in the process and that the process will continue. And it's that way for me, that the steps, you know, I know in the beginning I did the steps. I did them because I had to. You made me, you know. I mean, there was no escape. I mean, people were just incessant about the steps. But I did them. You know, I did the paperwork. And over the years, it's honestly, it feels to me like water pouring over a stone. It's just a gradual, slow progression of water that just flows over a stone. And enough years go by, and that stone gets carved away. And that's what my experience with the steps has been. That's a way of describing it, is that, you know, these principles started out to be just, you know, ideas. They were just a new version of the Ten Commandments or whatever, you know. I mean, it's just it was a new set of rules. And, you know, little by little, you begin to try to live by them. But gradually, the principles behind these things seep in to my life. And they have changed who I am. They have changed me. And I am so grateful for that. I'm telling you, women who come from what I come from don't get to live, most of us don't get to live like I live today. You know, I have more joy and more peace than I've ever known. More joy. And I can't honestly say that I knew what joy was even before, even through drinking. You know, I often say I didn't have a life that was worth living before I found booze, you know. But anyway, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a mess and in big trouble with my drinking, and I still had my children. I came into AA for the first time in February of 1981, and I wanted life to be better. You know, I wanted the uglies to stop. I wanted it to get a little more reasonable. And I thought that if I stopped drinking, that that's what would do it. And what I didn't know is that you know, consuming alcohol. What happens to me when I drink is a symptom of my disease, and when I stop drinking, that is the only way I know how to cope. That's the only thing that makes it okay for me to be Donna. And when I stop drinking, I not only have all those things I've been running from all this time, but I have everything new that I've created for myself. And it's just, you know, time and time and time again, the pain of being sober would get worse than the fear of getting loaded. And I would go out over and over and over and over. You know, in another 3 weeks or so, I'm going to be 20 years sober, and I just can't even believe that that's happened to me. I mean, I couldn't do 20 days. Honestly, I must have had a box full of 30-day chips. You know, I was just, it was ridiculous. I was desperate, though, and, you know, I'm just lucky. I'm one of the very lucky ones that I didn't die in that process, you know, that I just kept coming back. But I want to share with the people that are kind of new maybe some of the big mistakes that I made back then. And one of the big mistakes that I made was that I thought that if I could just not drink, that life would be better. You know, I mean, I stop hearing those horrible reports about, don't you remember what you did last night, which makes you just want to smack somebody, you know. I mean, it's always ugly, ugly stuff. It's never anything nice. It's always embarrassing. It's always usually has to do with losing garments, pieces of clothing, and, you know, I don't know, those reports. But I hated that. I hated it. I came into AA thinking that that was the deal, that if I could just stop drinking. And what I didn't know was that I didn't have a life that was worth living before I found booze. I mean, I was that little kid walking around with no answers, and I was terrified, and I believed that every ugly thing that had ever happened in my life was my fault. And there was a lot of ugly things that had happened. And I don't know where I got these ideas. I don't know about you guys, but I have a brain that creates information for me whenever I need it. And it's just, you know, it's unchallenged fact is what it is. I always say that when they read in the beginning of the meetings, and they always say that our old ideas, that our results were nil unless we let go of our old ideas. Old ideas, the problem with old ideas is they don't look like old ideas. They look like facts. They look like unchallenged pieces of information. And that's what I was holding on to, you know. I thought that that if I could just stop drinking, that everything would be okay. And what I didn't realize is that I would go back to that person with a mountain of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. I mean, that's what I get to go back to when I don't have an answer for living. And so I would come into AA, and I'd stay here until I couldn't stand it one more stinking lousy minute. And another thing that I did was that I came into AA, and I tried to do what you do and talk like you talk and dress like you dress. And, you know, I always say I was running around AA meetings pouring coffee and reading how it works, and nothing was changing. And one of the secrets that I was dying from pretty regularly is that I came into AA, and people asked me, how are you? And I'd say, good, I'm doing good, you know. And what I didn't tell you is that sometimes I just feel like I'm going to pass out. I'm so scared. I mean, I feel like my heart's just going to pound through my chest. I don't even know what I'm afraid of. I'm just afraid. That happens often at night for me, you know. I didn't know that if I told you those things that you would say, oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, that's going to get better. Or this is what I did. Or here's something to try. I wouldn't do that. I mean, that's what I saw you guys do. I saw you come in the rooms and say you were happy, joyous, and free, you know. I saw people come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and say they'd never had it so good. So that's what I'm doing. What I didn't know is that there's a process that you have to go through to get there, you know. But I missed that entirely, you know. Those are some of the things that I did wrong. And so time and time again, I would go back out. And, you know, it just got to be extremely tedious. Over the period of 7 years that I probably had to raise my hand as a newcomer maybe 30 times. And it wasn't weeks, it was a matter of days. I would get drunk over and over and over. And it was a long time for me before I met somebody that helped me, was somebody that I could hear. I'll tell you what happened. My kids left, drank up my kids. I had given away two of my kids, my middle daughter and my only son. I had given them to their father. And I had my reasons for doing that. I told myself that, you know, I had these five kids and they're all ages 6 through 0, and you know, I just had it, I had all my logic worked out about why this was a responsible thing to do, but honest to God, that was the single most destructive, selfish decision I've ever made. You know, the truth is I couldn't live like I wanted to live and be trying to take care of those kids. So I had given my middle daughter and my son to my ex-husband, and then my alcoholism really took off because of the guilt of being away from my kids and grieving them. And so I still had the three kids for quite a while and continued to get more and more and more trouble in AA, and eventually I lost all my kids. They went to visit their dad over Christmas, and they never came home. And I knew then that I needed to get sober or die. And I had been trying to get sober already for almost 5 years. And there was a guy in Billings that I used to hear once in a while. He used to say, you can sit in a chicken coop till your butt falls off. It won't make you a chicken. And he used to say that that's the way it is in AA, that you can sit in meetings day in and day out, and it doesn't give you recovery unless something changes. You know, that this is a gift of grace, but it's also a program of action and responsibility and activity. I mean, there are things that we do that make us stay here while that water pours over us to change who we are, you know? There's a place in the book, too, that says that if you keep drinking, you'll come to a place where you can't imagine life with alcohol and you can't imagine it without. And it says that you come to the jumping off place and you'll know loneliness such as few do, and you'll wish for the end. It also says that you come to a place where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. And that's what happened for me those last 2 years after the kids left. But in that interim, I went to treatment one time, and I came out of treatment, and I had 30 days, and that was a prize that was so hard for me to get. And I managed to stay in meetings. I was going to meetings right where I'm going now. I go into 510 Cook. It's this amazing little meeting hall, and I get to go to meetings there, and I remember being there when I was so new and so scared. And it's so cool for me to be back in the very same place. I remember going into meetings. I went to meetings there all the time. And the new people that are here, you know, I mean, you can go to a lot of meetings, but it won't give you recovery. And that's what I was doing. I thought I was doing what you did. And I would go to meetings. I remember this guy they called Sweet William. And he, one night he said to me, boy, I sure see you at these meetings a lot. And I said, yeah, you know, I figure if I keep coming around here long enough, maybe I'll feel like I belong. And he just looked at me and said, hey, we accepted you the minute you walked in the door. You need to accept us. That was something I had never even thought of. I mean, it didn't occur to me that I am walking in there as a separate entity and remaining that way, walking out of the room the same way. I mean, all this time, I think I'm going to AA. But there is such a difference between attending AA meetings and becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is such a difference. I was confused over that comment. I mean, there were people in AA I heard say stuff that just baffled me. There was this old cowboy that used to sit around and had manure on his boots and a big chunk of Copenhagen in his lip, you know, chewing tobacco. And he would say things like, you know, when it comes to pain and sobriety, sometimes you just got to be like the mule in the hailstorm. You just got to hunker down and take it. And I thought, God, I was just really hoping for more than that, you know? It was not good. And there was somebody there who always said that when it came to drinking, he was like the tomcat making love to the skunk. He said, I hadn't had all I wanted, but I had all I could stand. Anyway, I'm in and out of AA. And I did a geographic, and I went over to Kona, Hawaii, still going to meetings, always going to meetings. Went over to Kona. I'm going to meetings every day. I can't stay sober. I managed to stay sober over there for quite a little stretch, though, but I knew it was inevitable. I knew it was coming. I was one of those people who thought I was going to be the exception to everybody's rule. You know, everybody in AA told me what I should do and shouldn't do, and I ran it through my calculator, and it never came up the same as what they said. Like, I had been a bartender for a number of years, and in AA, they frown on that. They thought it was a bad idea for me to be a bartender. And I was like, well, you don't understand. You know, I really like it, and I'm really good at it, and I'm not going to drink. And I did that. I bartended sober for a little while. And what happened to me was the day, you know, when I'm doing okay, it's a commodity to me. It means nothing. I occasionally have to be around alcohol today. It doesn't bother me a bit. But when I'm not okay, it's an answer to my problem. I mean, I remember walking into work one night, Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was service bartending. I was bartending for a bunch of waiters and waitresses, and they would come in with huge drink orders. And so I'm setting up all these drinks and pouring drinks. And the waiter came up to get them, and he said to me, "Is that gin or vodka?" And without even thinking, I grabbed a straw and stuck it in the drink and put it in my mouth. Just a drop. Just a drop. And it was a first I'd had in over a year. And it was like, oh, my God, it went through me like a shock. But I told him, whatever it was, it's gin or whatever. And he picked him up and walked away. And you think that, you know, if I didn't ever believe that I had an allergy to alcohol, I know for a fact because of that experience, one drop of alcohol sets up a craving for me that says more. Give me more. And it was only, it was a matter, I mean, a couple days later, I walk into work and I'm looking at those bottles and I'm thinking, well, gee, if I was going to drink, what would I drink? You know, and my boss came in one night and she said, make me a separator. She said, I want to be separated from myself. And I knew exactly what that felt like. I was like, oh boy, you're in trouble. You know, and I'm telling you, I am powerless over alcohol. Alcohol is a greater power than me. And it made me happy, joyous, and free for the first time, but it also calls all the rules, all of the shots in my life. And try as much as I tried to get away from it, I couldn't do it. I'm in Kona. I'd been sober a little while. I had that experience I just told you about, and I ended up getting drunk. Tried to get my kids back, and they wouldn't come back. And so that was my reason for staying sober. And I got drunk. You know, and I would go to the meetings. I would go to the stinking meetings. I mean, that's exactly what I did not want to do, but I would go to the meetings. And they in Kona, they always said, is there anybody here for their first, second, or third meeting since their last drink? And then everybody would look at me, see if I'm going to raise my hand today, you know. I was getting so angry at those people, man. They just, there's just nothing worse than being in an AA meeting and being miserable and feeling separate and feeling like you're dying and you can't get it, you know. I was just a mess. I was in a meeting one night, and there was a guy that was leading the meeting who I particularly hated. He had about 20 years. He was always saying really rude and annoying things to me. He was always yanking my chain, you know, just always picking on me. I don't know what the thing is about that, but he always did. And at the end of this meeting, Frank said, is there anybody here that has a burning desire? And he looked right at me. And I just blew up at him. You know, I just went, yeah, you know what, Frank, I got a burning desire for you. I said, you people just make me sick. You know, you are always telling me that sober is better, and sober doesn't feel better to me. It feels worse. I hate this. I hate my life. I hate being here. I hate you. I hate, just kind of barfed all over the meeting, you know. And when I shut up, everybody kind of got quiet. You know, they're probably thinking, is she armed? You know. And then somebody said, right on, Donna, keep coming back. You know, I thought, God, you guys are weird, you know. You are hopelessly weird. And after the meeting that night, I said to this kid, I said, man, I don't know why this program won't work for me, but it just won't work. And he said, how many days has it been since you drank? And, you know, it was 45 days. I mean, that's a long time between drinks if you have no solution, you know. And I said, 45 days. And he goes, well, what makes you think it isn't working? You know, I said, well, was I going too fast for you or something? I mean, you like this. I hate this. I hate being here. You're all, I'm happy, joyous, and free. I've never had it so good. Everything's just great in your life, and I am miserable. You know, and he picked up a 12 and 12, and he opened it to the seventh step. And there's one sentence in there. It says, in every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. In every case, not sometimes, not most of us. In every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe what I'm going through isn't for nothing. You know, I was a mess. I went to the meeting the next night, and I met a lady that changed everything for me. I mean, just changed it. She was an amazing woman. She was somebody that just lit up the room when she walked in the room. She had like 27 years of sobriety. She was absolutely gorgeous. She had this big old smile on her, and she just had a light coming from her that was unbelievable. She She was, you know, probably pushing 70, but she was absolutely gorgeous. She was just so awesome. Her name was Phyllis C. I'd never met her before that day, and she had just arrived on the island. Her husband had just died of brain cancer, and she had some friends in Kona who said, come on over here and let us just love on you for about a month. You know, you just come on over here and let us heal you up, you know. So she showed up, and they stood right behind the podium on a Saturday night, you know. You would not have known. I did not know what she had just been through. She stood up there and she told her story, and man, she just rang my bell. I mean, she just, first of all, she was 36 when she got sober. I was 36. She neglected and abused and loved and cherished her kids. She talked about her little two-year-old. When she got sober, she had a little two-year-old boy named Patrick, and she said Patrick stuttered really bad. And she said every time that child opened his mouth to talk, she said she felt like she had done that to him. And I knew remorse that you have over your kids and the way you feel. And she also talked about that mountain of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. You know, she talked about that. And I thought, man, this lady knows how I've lived. You know, I just fell in love with her. And I spent every minute that I could. She had this cool gift that I believe that you get after you've been around AA for a while, and that is that she could just look around the room and pick out the sickest woman there and go right for her, you know? And she came up and put her arm around me, and she said, baby, you just stay by me, and everything's going to be fine. And I just melted, I'm telling you. You know, if she'd have told me what I needed to do or what I was doing wrong or what I didn't do right, you know, I'm not so sure I'd have made it. But she just came up and said, hey, you just stick by me, and everything's going to be okay. She said, you know, if I had a daughter, she'd be just like you. She'd be really sick. She was so cool. So I was with Phyllis on the beach the next day. We're laying on the beach. And I said, you know, Phyllis, I probably need to do another fourth step, right? And she said, no, baby, you just need to do a first step, that's all. You know? And I said, man, I don't know what you mean. I mean, I know for a fact that I'm an alcoholic. I've got no problem with the first step. How do you do a first step? And she said that there's implied action in the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that we are powerless over alcohol and that our lives are unmanageable. And she said the implied action there is that you need to find new management. She said you need to find a power greater than you are that will solve your problem. And I'm like, okay, you know, no problem. She said, well, then tell me about your higher power. What kind of higher power do you have? So I started telling her about the churches that I went to when I was a kid. You know, I mean, that's what I knew about God. And she interrupted me, and she said, let me tell you something. She said, any God that you could understand will be too small for your needs. Man, she just knocked me over, you know. I'd never heard that before. She said, you've been trying to do this a long time, and it's not working. Excuse me. She said, maybe you should be willing to consider something else. And I said, like what? And she said, well, think about this. She said, when you lay down at night and you go to sleep, your lungs inflate and deflate all night long, and your heart beats all night long, and there's nothing that you do before you go to bed that makes that happen. I'm like, okay. She said, when your time on this earth is up, there is nothing you could do to add one more minute to your time on this planet. When your time is up, you're gone. And I said, all right. She said, then that is a power greater than yourself. She said, that's something you didn't create, and it's something you can't control. And she said, if you wake up in the morning and you're breathing, then you are a spiritual being, and God loves you as if you were his only child. And, you know, I know for a fact I didn't know what any of that meant, but I sure liked the way it sounded. I said, well, don't I need to know who God is? I mean, shouldn't I know who I'm going to turn my life and my will over to? And she said, no, it's none of your business who God is. She said, God knows who he is. If you talk to him, he'll answer you, you know? I mean, it's just so simple. I go, well, what do I call him? And she plays it all straight. She goes, well, you could call him God. I mean, I'm not kidding. It was that simple, you know? And I mean, I thought about this a lot. I remember thinking, you know, if I could find, she said, if God loved me as if I were his only child. You know, that was a hook for me because I was grieving my kids so bad. I missed them so bad. And I had so much guilt and shame and remorse over the way I had treated them. And I wanted so badly to have another opportunity to be a mother to them, to be the kind of mother that I know I am. And she said that God loved me as if I were his only child. And I thought, you know, if I could find a God that loved me half as much as I love those kids, I bet that'd do it. I bet that would be enough for me. She also said that it was, she said, if you wake up and you're breathing, she said, look, whatever the difference between a live body and a dead body is, that's a big deal. That's something you didn't make happen. You can't make it stay. You can't bring it back once it's gone. I mean, that's a big deal. So she said that life force that's within you, she said, if you ever wake up and you're not breathing, you won't be here, you know? And it was just so simple. It was something I could get my head around. She said that my spirituality was a given. She said, your spirituality is a done deal. It's not something you need to create. It's something you need to accept. She said, you just address yourself to God and see what happens. Don't worry about answering, you know, is it Buddha? Is it Jesus? Is it Great White Buffalo? Is it, what is it going to be, you know? I always had to figure out the meaning of the universe before I can take the second step, you know? Which might have had something to do with why I wasn't staying sober. Anyway, it was just so simple to me. And she talked about my breath. She said, if you wake up and you're breathing, you know? So I went back into the meetings in Kona and told everybody I had a new higher power, and it was my breath. And they said, that's nice, honey, just keep coming back, you know? And I meant it, because here is the deal. I would open my mouth and inhale to pray, and I could feel the air on the back of my tongue. And it was the first time for me that I had ever gone within to find a little place of peace, ever. I had always been praying to some God out here somewhere that may or may not help me, depending on if I'm good. That's another piece of my unchallenged information, unchallenged fact, is that if you want to live a spiritual, this way I thought, is that if you want to live a spiritual way of life, you have to be good, because God is good, sin is bad. I mean, this is clear. Everyone knows this. These are the rules everyone is familiar with. Now, I don't know how successful you are at that, but I can only be really, really, really good for just a little while. And then I'm going to be bad, you know? I mean, I just do. I say something I shouldn't say, or buy something I shouldn't buy, or think something I shouldn't think. I mean, it's just, I'm a goner, you know? I'm hopeless. And so now that I've been bad, God isn't going to help me. Those are my old ideas. But that's the way I thought. That's what it was supposed to be, you know? And she said, no. She said, you need to accept this. She said, your spirituality is a given. She said, you are breathing. You wake up in the morning and you are alive. God is there. That gift of life is within you. And that is where it began. It was as simple as that. And, you know, I mean, I thought, well, do I need to decide, you know, what religion I'm going to have? It's so hard to talk to a newcomer about a spiritual experience, because they always go to religion as if it is the same thing. And it in my experience, it's not the same thing. But it was to me then. And it was because I had had a religious experience, but I had never had a spiritual experience. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the beginning. Phyllis gave me the key to unlock that door that had been closed to me forever, you know, that I had these old ideas. She just said, it's a done deal. And I just, you know, I would sit down and pray, and I would feel that air on my tongue, and I just felt like, okay, God is here, you know. And she said, it's just as simple as that. I said, what do I do? And she said, tonight when you're alone, you just get on your knees and say a prayer like this. And she said, you'd say it however you want to say it, but the idea that you want to throw out there is something like, God, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you want from me, but if you want anything to do with what's left of my life, then come on, because I don't know where to go from here, you know? That was the most honest prayer I think I'd ever heard. There was no bargaining there. There was no, I'll be good, you know, I won't ever do it again. I'll do this if you do that, and, you know, it was just plain, man, if you're out there and you want to do the deal, then let's do the deal. And what happened for me is God, in very small ways, began to manifest himself in my life, and I have stayed sober. I mean, it's been the most amazing experience. The beginning for me was just that. I latched on to that like, you know, like a dying man and a life preserver. I mean, I just had the answer, you know, and I went about busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to fix everything that was wrong with your life, and I'm very capable of doing that. I went into this with a vengeance. You know, this was my answer, and this is what I believed. But I got to tell you that my spiritual experience was significant to bring about recovery from alcoholism, but it was small. It stayed right there with God. I don't know who you are or what you want from me. And it was sufficient. Years went by. I stayed in the rooms of AA. I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring women. I'm running around doing a little talking and being of service, secretary this, treasurer that. I'm there. I'm right in the middle of everything. And, you know, I had a sponsor, Barbara D., who died in 1997, and she got sober in 1957. She was cool too. She was only 70. She was only 70 when she died. She got married. She got sober really young. One day Barbara says to me, she said, you know, I think you've got a really good sober life here. I'd married a man in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are Mr. and Mrs. AA. You know, we are running around being little star pupils, you know, and making sure everybody knew us and very out in front and very involved in service. And it was cool. It was really great. She said, you know, you've got a really good life going on here. But she said, I'm worried about you. And I'm like, why? You know, I listen. When my sponsor says she's worried about me, I want to know why. And she said, I just am afraid of something really bad ever happened in your life that you'd get drunk. She said, I think your sobriety is attached to Terry, to this man that you're married to, you know. He was 17 years sober when I met him, and I was brand new, and I married him, and we were, you know, trudging the road to happy destiny together. And so it shook me up. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, he's a little older than you. He's 12 years older than you. I just think that if something happened to Terry, that I'm not so sure you'd stay sober. I'm not so sure that this is your experience. I think that this is an experience from your relationship. And I said, well, what do I do? And she said, why don't you make yourself an earthquake plan? And I was living in Southern California, and so earthquakes are something I'm very familiar with. And I said, you know, what's that? And she said, you make yourself, sit down and make a contract as to what your behavior will be if the wheels ever fall off. And she said, be really careful before you write this stuff down, because she said, this is not negotiable. If you agree to do this, if this is what you will do if it ever gets really tough, then you are going to have to follow through this contract, because it's a personal contract just between you and God. So I was like, okay, you know. So I put a lot of thought into it, and I thought, well, I'd go to meetings every day. You know, I just go to meetings every day, because I know me and those 7 years of being in and out. I know when I don't show up, if I miss one, I'll miss 10. You know, I just... And then it isn't long before it's easier to stay away than it is to go back. And so I thought, well, I won't miss any meetings, and I won't give up any service commitments. I'll stay active in service. I'll sponsor the women I sponsor. I'll be sponsored. And I thought, I knew two women who had lost their husbands over a period of a few years before that, and I watched both of those women do the same thing. The first thing that they did was remodel their houses and then sell their cars and buy a new one, and you know, then they sold their house and then they moved away, and it was kind of like one of those retail therapy things, which I can totally relate with, where it's like if I change enough of the outside, the inside will feel better. And what happened for both those ladies was the same thing. About a year later, they ended up broke and back in town, you know, where you come back home where you're supposed to be, and they had to start over again. They had to face the big boogeyman. And so I thought, okay, I won't do anything big, you know, for a year. I won't buy anything more than a sweater or something like that. I mean, I'll avoid any drastic changes. It seemed to me to be pretty reasonable and not too hard to carry out. So I wrote all this stuff up, and I took it to Barbara, and Barbara said, yeah, that looks good. Sign it. I signed it. About 2 years later, my son died, just like Beverly shared, was shared later last night about, you know, I mean, they're just things that happen in sobriety. I've lost two children since I've been sober. Three of my sponsors have died. My dad died. You know, real life goes down. And in the beginning, it was, you know, never supposed to happen to me. That's the way I looked at it. Don't you get what I do to stay sober? Don't you get the work I do in Alcoholics Anonymous? Why is this happening to me? Well, when my son died, I had an opportunity to pull that earthquake plan out and do it. And I thought, when I drew up that plan, that if I did those things, if I took the right actions, that the right things would happen. And let me tell you how that translates in my brain, that if I do the right things, that I will feel better. And the truth is, I didn't feel better. I just did the right thing. All it did was allow me to stay here. And I was unhappy and angry and resentful. All the things that we are warned repeatedly not to be, you know, if you expect to grow spiritually. But here was something that had come down in my life that I had no tools to deal with and had no idea what to do. And, you know, I am a very determined woman. And what I did was absolutely everything I could think of doing to make myself better. And at the end of a year, I wasn't better. I was worse, you know. But by the grace of God, I just managed to stay in AA. And I got to tell you that things did begin to get a little bit better. It was 2 years and 9 months later, my second daughter died. My son committed suicide. He was 19 years old, and he jumped off a cliff. And he had been to AA, and he couldn't get sober. He was pouring coffee and reading How It Works, you know, and nothing was changing. And he couldn't get sober, and he went out for a while. And he wrote a note saying that he couldn't live like this anymore and that he'd already been to AA and it didn't work for him. And so that was his action. That's what he did. And 2 years and 9 months later, my second daughter, Tracy, was 25 years old and 5 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing woman. Just a pistol of a girl, you know. Everybody called her Tracer the Racer. She was just a pew, go all the time. Married, had a little daughter of her own. Andrea was 3, almost 4. And Tracy just got sick and died. Just boom. Within 4 days, she was gone. She just got a virus that destroyed her heart. And it just was, you know. What I want to share about that is what happened to me as a result of those things. And in a way, they have been the most precious gifts of my life. It took me from a place of, God, I don't know who you are or what you want from me. It was time to find a God of my understanding or flat die, you know. And thank God we have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have environments like this where everyone is doing the best they can to grow along spiritual lines. It's a perfect place for me to be, you know. I was so angry, though. Man, I was angry. I felt like I'd been digging myself out from underneath a pile of crap about as long as I could remember, you know. I mean, I didn't have a nice way of growing up, and then I did everything I did as a drunk, as an alcoholic woman, and that was horrible. And then I finally get sober after 7 years of trying to get sober. And see, I don't know whether you're hearing this or not, but it was really quite all about me. I thought that I was, you know, the reason things were going so stellar in my life up until 7 years of sobriety is because I was doing such a great job of being sober. I mean, people would say to me, you know, this is a gift. And I'd like, yeah, it's a gift, but I'm showing up for service commitments. I'm sponsoring people. I'm doing this. I'm doing that, you know. And it took these experiences for me to realize that it's the results that come from taking those actions, not the actions themselves that change me. You know, it's amazing. It is amazing to me. I hit a surrender. It was the first of many, but I hit some surrenders in my life, and I got to tell you, God has been so faithful for me. About a year after Tracy died, I'm still busy in AA and still trying to do the best I can, but I'm very angry and very resentful, very frustrated, and I remember one day, I went to a women's conference, actually, and I heard a woman named Mari G from Toronto, and Mari talked about her prayer. And she said her prayer in the morning, she put her arms up like this, she said, my prayer in the morning is that God would take whatever he wants to take and leave whatever he wants to leave. And she said that can be a scary prayer because God might figure you don't need very much. And I remember when I heard her say that, I went, oh, no, 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 no. I have just buried 2 kids and 3 sponsors, and, you know, I've had it about up to here. I mean, I couldn't possibly tell God he can take whatever he wants to take. And I seriously struggled with this. That night I was in my room, and I was just thinking, oh, man, what am I supposed to do with this? I couldn't imagine surrendering to that point. The thought came to me, you know, Donna, life has been happening to you for quite some time now, completely without your permission, you know. I thought, well, that's true. And then I thought, you know, the one thing that would really be tragic, the real tragedy, would be if I lost my sobriety. Because my sobriety is my relationship with God. It is through being sober that I've been able to establish a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I thought, you know, that would be the true loss. That would be the big loss. Then the next thought I had is, I am the only one who can take that away from me. Isn't that amazing? I am the only one who can give away this gift of sobriety. That's amazing. I mean, it isn't whether they live or whether they die, whether you stay married or get divorced. It isn't whether you have money or whether you don't, or whether you're well or whether you're not. It doesn't matter. The only one who can give up this gift is me. And I felt safe like I've never felt safe. I made a deal with God that night. I said, you know, I will do whatever you want me to do. I will live anywhere, work anywhere, do anything, but you have got to give me some peace and help me stay sober. And you know what? God has done exactly that and more. I've had years in my sobriety. The last 10 years, I got to tell you that I felt like I was sort of walking in the dark, you know? I'm just trying to, I was changing a lot of things out here, trying to make it feel better in here. My marriage ended not long after Tracy died, and I went through the last 5 years of just kind of floundering around. I knew better than to try to, you know, suck another relationship in there right away, because, I mean, I didn't know up from down, but I knew that, you know, this was not the time to be inviting company. I was a mess, and it was time for me to just be with me. And I did that. And, you know, I stayed in AA, and what happened for me was just this spring, I hit a place after making a series of changes in my life that I thought were going to make things better. I ended up at that brick wall one more time. And what I realized just this last spring is that, man, I've been running from this as long as I can remember. And that is the idea of doing life, just me and God. That just scared me to death. And, you know, back when I was brand new and got together with Terry, that's exactly what I did. I went, I'm too scared to do my life. Let's just do yours, you know. And he was real happy with that arrangement. And, you know, that had to change over the years, and it ended up in the downfall of that marriage. But it also allowed me, when I found that out, it allowed me to find my part in the demise of that marriage, is that this was, you know, was on the wrong basis from the very beginning. So I just kind of, you know, ended up spiraling down into this little crumble, what I felt anyway. And really what it was it was just the most amazing, beautiful time. I came to a place of peace in my life that I've never known. Peace not just with God, but with myself. Peace where I'm really okay with me, and I'm really comfortable with what I do. I don't have to worry about keeping secrets. You know, there isn't much that I do that you can't watch. I mean, it's just, you know, my life is truly exactly what I'm telling you it is, and it's the most amazing thing. I turned around and went to work in this little community that I was living in, and the love just poured into my life. You just can't even believe it. You know, I ended up deciding that I wanted to be a massage therapist, something that I've always been involved in healing in some area or another, and I became a massage therapist, and I just love it. I mean, it just fills me up so much, and it's allowed me to, you know, really break down some more of those walls that stood between me and other people. I was just telling Ellen, I had an experience about halfway through massage school where all of a sudden one day I realized I was no longer massaging this leg, I was massaging a person. And it was, you know, it just was the most amazing thing. It has been, Polly has always told me, you know, you keep doing what God puts in front of you, and this is going to be your path to healing. She has always told me that. And she has not lied to me. She has never been wrong. She has walked through all of this with me. I got to a place in the spring where I thought, you know what, life is just so dang good. I just am really happy. I love my life. I have people in Alcoholics Anonymous who love me, who let me love them back. I have a feeling of purpose and usefulness. I love what I'm doing to make a living. I like how I'm living. I like who I am. And it was just fabulous. And it wasn't very long after that before this cowboy walked right into my life, you know. And I got to tell you, I met Bob 2 years before this. I'd known him through Alcoholics Anonymous in service in the Billings area, and I had always watched him, and I'd always really admired his program, because he just loves AA. There's certain people who have just a complete passion for it, and there's lots of people who really love AA, but there are certain people that just are nuts about it, you know, and he is. And when I, you know, when Bob and I started talking, the one thing that I knew for sure is that we were going to be best friends. I mean, honestly, it didn't cross my mind that, you know, this would be the next him. It didn't do that. What happened was he started calling me every night. We spent 2 or 3 hours a night on the phone every night. Long emails, pictures, just, I mean, it was awesome. And I would get off the phone and look at my little dog, Wiz, and I would say, Wiz, I'm in trouble, man. I'm falling in love with this man. You know, I fell in love with Bob on the phone. What I fell in love with was his heart for service and the way he loves newcomers and the way he treats his family and the principles that he lives by. And plus, I think he's just the most drop-dead gorgeous man I've ever seen in my life. But, you know, again, I'm just leaving it up to God. I'm not going to do anything. Don't want to push the envelope. And, you know, what happened is that we both wanted the same things. We both found exactly what we've been looking for a long time. And when you're not even looking. I mean, I can't tell you I was looking. I was really not looking. Bob is my best friend. He is my best friend, and he is my comrade in sobriety, and we have so stinking much fun. It's just ridiculous. And my life is good today. My children are amazing women. We got married at my daughter's house in January, and my daughters threw a wedding for us, and my sponsor's husband, Dave, came and walked me down the aisle and gave me away, and Bob's sponsor, Donnie, flew from Montana and stood there and watched us get married, and friends came. People from the program from Nebraska came, and my daughters and my grandchildren were there. My oldest daughter remarried this last June to a man who is just phenomenal. Tony is his name. He's just, I'm telling you, he is precious. And she is so stinking happy, it's ridiculous. And she had a little girl that was 5. And when Bob and I came in the house and she met, you know, Grandma and Bob, she went running over to Trina and she goes, "Look, Mom, you have 2 dads now, too." It was just so cool. I mean, these kids just threw themselves into our lives. And my middle daughter, Tawny, is married to one of the finest men I think I've ever met. And they live in Toronto. They've been married 9 years. They're having their second baby in June. And I got on my refrigerator at home, stuck up there with a magnet, is my ticket to go see Tawny and help her when she has that baby, you know. And I just am so grateful for that. I'm telling you, if I got what I had coming to me, those kids wouldn't walk across the street to spit on me, you know. And today, who do they call when the wheels fall off, you know? Because they know I'm not going to try to fix it. They know that I'm not going to should on them. I mean, I have made my mistakes. I have made my choices. I have lived the way I wanted to live. Why would I deprive you of that? Why would I deprive anyone of that? You know, I'm convinced that God, in His mercy, has given us a life that is truly beyond anything that any of us could have imagined. And it doesn't depend on my certainty or my feeling, you know, particularly emotionally healthy or mentally healthy, you know. It really isn't about me. It's like my life isn't any of my business. I just get to come here and do what God asked me to do. I pray every day for God to help me to be the woman that He wants me to be. And lately I've been praying more for faith. Because in spite of the fact that I love my life and I love these principles and I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love my higher power, in spite of that, there still remains in me a place that just doesn't quite believe that God loves me. And so lately I've been praying, you know, I don't know if you have that, but if you do, I've just been praying, God, help me to not do that. You know, just help me to not do that. Help me to enlarge my faith. Help me to do Your work. Help me to be the woman You want me to be. And I'm telling you, it is just the greatest life I could have ever imagined. I love you all so much, and thank you for your patience today and all your hospitality.